federal government. The system can be changed by the will of the people, and the public officials who administer the system can, with very few exceptions, be retired on short notice. So far, no better system of human relationship has been found, and no better system is in the prospect of being found within the near future. Perhaps no better system than ours will ever be found, and none will be necessary as long as our present system is managed as its founders intended it should be managed, for the greatest possible benefits to all, with special privileges for none.
You made some brief reference to application of the mastermind principle in the successful operation of the home, Mr. Carnegie. Will you now go further into this subject and explain just how this principle can be applied in the management of the home?
I'm glad you thought of this, because my experience has taught me that a man's home relationships have an important bearing on his business and professional achievements. The alliance between a man and a woman in marriage creates a relationship which reaches deeply into the spiritual nature of both parties. Marriage is, therefore, the most favorable of alliances for the effective use of the mastermind principle.
I suppose, Mr. Carnegie, that in marriage, as in all other relationships, there are certain precautions one can take to ensure the successful operation of the mastermind principle. Will you name and discuss the more important of these safeguards for me, sir?
Heading the list is the choice of a mate. A successful marriage begins with an intelligent choice of a partner. Let me explain what I mean by an intelligent choice. In the first place, a man should test his prospective partner in marriage through a series of frank and intimate talks with her. He should tell her how he intends to make a living and be very sure she is in full accord with him, both as to his chosen occupation and his methods of following it. It will be of priceless help to a man if his wife becomes so thoroughly sold on his occupation and his method of earning his living that her interest may be described as intensely enthusiastic. But her minimum interest in this very important fundamental of the marriage partnership should be an unreserved approval of his occupation. Failure to have an understanding on this subject has destroyed the possibility of applying the mastermind principle in many marriages.
Mr. Carnegie, what do you think about the so-called eternal triangles we hear so much about, where married men become interested in other women more than in their wives?
I think it is no exaggeration to say that most of them have their beginning in the discovery of lack of interest by their wives in their chosen work. It is a part of a man's nature to seek close association with those who show a keen interest in his work. A man's ego needs food in the form of personal encouragement, and no one is in as favorable a relationship with him to supply this as his wife.
Well, Mr. Carnegie, what about instances where a man and his wife are engaged in the same occupation, or the same business, and are working together for a common purpose?
In every instance I have observed such circumstances, I was impressed by the fact that their close association in occupation led also to a close relationship in their social affairs, which left very little surplus time for either of them to become interested in anyone else or in anything that did not concern both.
Is there any other advantage to a man and his wife having a mutual interest in the source of the family income, Mr. Carnegie?
Yes, because this leads to a mutual understanding regarding their household and personal expenses. If a man's wife knows precisely how he makes his money and how much he makes, she will, if she is a faithful partner, adjust her household and personal expenditures to fit his income. Moreover, she will do it cheerfully.
So far, Mr. Carnegie, you have spoken for the benefit of the man who has not yet chosen a life partner in marriage. What about the man who is already married? What can he do if he has chosen a wife who has no interest in his occupation, or perhaps no common interest with him on any subject?
In most cases of this sort, it calls for a reselling job on the husband's part, with the object of inducing the wife to begin all over again, under a plan that will ensure close cooperation between them. There are but few marriages which do not need a new and improved plan of relationship at frequent intervals to ensure the fullest measure of benefits to both parties to the marriage and to their children where there are children.
What is the plan for improving and maintaining relationships you speak of, Mr. Carnegie? Can you give me some specific instructions?
The time would be well spent if married people set aside a regular hour for a confidential mastermind meeting at least once every week, during which they would come to an understanding concerning every vital factor of their relationship, both in and outside of the home associations. Continuous contact between a man and his wife is an essential for harmony and cooperative effort.
I take it, Mr. Carnegie, that you definitely do not approve of either party to a marriage taking things for granted. Is that correct?
It is. The mastermind principle cannot be successfully applied in marriage without a deliberate, carefully planned program. An occasional discussion of the mutual affairs of marriage is not enough. There must be an established period set aside for the mastermind meetings, and this program should be respected and carried out with the same courtesy, the same definiteness of purpose, and the same formality that is observed by businessmen who use the mastermind principle for the management of their affairs. Fortunate indeed will be the couples who heed this counsel and make the fullest possible use of it, for they are sure to discover in it an approach to perfection in marriage which can never be attained through mere physical attraction or sex emotion.
In your last statement, Mr. Carnegie, you mentioned sex emotion. Because of the lack of education on the subject of sex, I realize its discussion calls for delicate discrimination. However, it is a subject of such major importance that it cannot be ignored. I recall that you placed the emotion of sex as the second of the 9 basic motives which spur men on to voluntary action. Undoubtedly, you, who understand men so well, have some words of wisdom for us on this subject, sir. Will you please discuss the subject as you see fit?
The emotion of sex is nature's own source of inspiration, through which she gives both men and women the impelling desire to create, build, lead, and direct. Every great artist, every great musician, and every great dramatist gives expression to the emotion of sex, transmuted into human endeavor. It is also true that men of vision, initiative, and enthusiasm who lead and excel in industry and business owe their superiority to transmuted sex emotion.
It is obvious that the emotion of sex is the major source of attraction which brings men and women together in marriage. For this reason, it is well for us to inquire into the relationship between the emotion of sex and the mastermind principle. What have you to say on this question, Mr. Carnegie?
The well-informed man will not be slow to recognize the possibilities available to him by combining the emotion of sex with whatever plan he adopts for the object of his mastermind alliance with his wife. The same suggestion offers stupendous benefits to the married woman, who is interested both in aiding her husband in his occupation and in holding his interest in herself. Let it be remembered, however, that the relationship of sex, to be of enduring benefit as a medium of inspiration, must be kept on a high pedestal of romance.
Why do you stress the importance of romance, Mr. Carnegie?
Because wherever evidence of greatness in men is found, no matter in what age or calling, there one may also find evidence of the spirit of romance. The acorn yields an oak tree only in response to the stimulus of the sun's rays. The bird breaks the shell and takes to wing only in response to warmth outside itself. And the seed of achievement that reposes in the brain of every man responds most quickly to the warmth of a woman's love and affection. Ignore the call of romance when it appeals to you from within, and you thereby hide your talents in the darkness of obscurity. On the contrary, listen for the call of this messenger of infinite intelligence. Treat it with civility and understanding when it arrives, and it will hand you the key to the temple of wisdom whose doors are locked within your heart and brain. all that is great and good in man and woman comes to be there only through God's gift of love. Keep the fire of romance burning. Let it become a part, an important part, of the mastermind ceremony, and your marital relationship will yield priceless returns in both material and spiritual measures.
From what you have said about the spirit of romance, Mr. Carnegie, I get the impression that it is a great driving force which may be used in the pursuit of a man's calling as well as in devotion to the object of his affection. Is that the impression you intend to convey?
That is precisely what I have been saying, and I have said it because the force that is born of a combination of love and sex is the very elixir of life through which nature expresses all creative effort. Understand this truth, and you will know why a man's greatest use of the mastermind principle is that which grows out of his alliance with the woman of his choice. And you will understand also why it is so essential for a man to keep his relationship with his wife on the plane of romance.
How does one go about kindling this emotional fire, which is so powerful?
The spirit of romance is born of the combination of the emotions of love and sex. Enthusiasm, driving force, keen interest, and vision are essential for success in any calling. And these states of mind can be produced at will by the person who converts the motives of sex and love, two of the strongest of the 9 basic motives, into an obsessional interest in his occupation. Romance is a blend of the emotions of love and sex. It is a healthy, normal impulse, if it is not degraded by physical desire. It takes drudgery from toil. It raises the thoughts of the most humble worker to the status of genius. It drives away discouragement and replaces it with definiteness of purpose. It transforms poverty into a mighty and irresistible power for achievement. It fires the imagination and forces it to become active and creative. It has been the heart and soul of every outstanding man of achievement who has ever left footprints on the sands of time.
Will you now analyze the mastermind principle as it applies to the efforts of an individual in his daily efforts to appropriate his share of American opportunity?
I will now analyze some of the individual uses of this great universal principle, as it may be applied in the development of various human relationships contributory to the attainment of one's major purpose in life. Every student of the philosophy of American achievement should recognize the fact that the attainment of his highest aim in life can be reached only by a series of steps, and that every thought he thinks, every transaction in which he engages in relationship with others, every plan he creates, and every mistake he makes has a vital bearing on his ability to attain his chosen goal. One's major purpose must be backed up and followed through by continuous effort, the most important part of which consists of the sort of effort that is applied in relationship with other people. With this truth well fixed in the mind, it is not difficult to understand how necessary it is for an individual to be careful in his choice of associates, especially those with whom he comes into close daily contact.
That being the case, Mr. Carnegie, will you name and discuss some of the sources of human relationship which the man with a definite major purpose in life must cultivate in his progress toward his chosen goal? What, for instance, is the first of such sources?
The first important source of human relationships, outside of marriage, is that which exists between a man and those with whom he works in the pursuit of his daily occupation. There is a tendency common to all men for an individual to take on the mannerisms, the mental attitude, the philosophy of life, the political viewpoints, the economic leaning, and the other general traits of the most outspoken of the men with whom he associates in his daily work. The tragedy of this tendency is the fact that not always is the most outspoken man among one's daily associates the soundest thinker, and very often he is a man with the poorest character. However, one may find in almost every group of associates in his daily work some persons whose influence and cooperation may be helpful. The discriminating man with a definite major purpose in life will prove his wisdom if he forms close friendships only with those who can be and are willing to be mutually beneficial to him. The others he will tactfully avoid. The man with a definite purpose will take careful inventory of every person with whom he is associated in his daily work, and he will look upon every such person as a possible source of knowledge or influence that he can borrow and use in his own promotion. If he looks around him intelligently, he will discover that his daily place of labor is literally a schoolroom in which he can acquire the greatest of all educations, that which comes from experience. The man with a constructive purpose in life will never envy his superiors. He will study their methods and appropriate their knowledge instead.
Well, Mr. Carnegie, how can one make the greatest use of the sort of schooling you have just mentioned?
By remembering the 9 basic motives, together with the suggestion that no one ever does anything without a motive. Men lend their experience, their knowledge, and their aid to other men because they have been given a sufficient motive for doing so. Obviously, the man who relates himself to his daily associates in a friendly, cooperative mental attitude stands a better chance of learning from them than the man who is belligerent, irritable, discourteous, or neglectful in the little amenities of courtesy that exist between all cultured people. The old saying that a man can catch more flies with honey than he can with salt might well be remembered by the man who wishes to go to school to his daily associates who know more than he does, and whose cooperation he needs and seeks.
Thank you, Mr. Carnegie, for a splendid summary of the advantages to be gained from what we might term an occupational mastermind alliance. What is another type of alliance which is necessary for the attainment of one's major purpose in life, sir?
Next in importance is an educational alliance. No man's education ever is finished. The man whose definite major purpose in life is of noteworthy proportions must continue to be a student, and he must learn from every possible source, especially those sources from which he can gather specialized knowledge and experience related to his major purpose. The public libraries are free. They offer a great array of organized knowledge on every subject known to civilization. They carry, in every language, the sum total of all man's knowledge. The successful man makes it his business to read books and to learn important facts concerning his chosen work, which have come from the experience of other men who have gone before him. A man's reading program should be as carefully chosen as his daily diet, for it, too, is food without which he cannot grow mentally. The man who spends all his reading time on the funny papers and the sex magazines is not headed toward great achievement. A man should include in his daily reading program some material which definitely provides him with knowledge which he can use in the attainment of his major purpose. Random reading may be pleasing, but it seldom is helpful in connection with a man's occupation.
Mr. Carnegie, you have stressed reading. Is reading the only source of education available to a man with a definite purpose in life?
Not at all. By a careful choice among his daily associates, a man may ally himself with men from whom he can acquire a very liberal education through ordinary conversation. Business and professional clubs offer an opportunity for one to form alliances of great educational benefit, provided a man chooses his clubs and his individual associations in them with a definite objective in mind. In this way, many men have formed both business and social acquaintances of great value to them in carrying out the object of their major purpose. No man can go through life successfully without the habit of cultivating friends. The word contact, as it is used in connection with personal acquaintanceship, is an important word. If a man makes it a part of his duty to extend his life of personal contacts, he will find the habit of use to him in ways that cannot be foreseen while he is cultivating his acquaintances. But the time will come when they will be ready and willing to aid him if he has done a good job of selling himself to them.
If you wish a job done promptly and well, get a busy man to do it. The idle man knows too many substitutes and shortcuts. Develop an attractive personality. Chapter 3.
Mr. Carnegie, we now come to the third of the 17 principles of individual achievement, which you have named attractive personality. I understand that you have separated the factors behind personality into distinct traits, all but one of which may be developed by any normal person. Now, sir, will you describe these characteristics of personality, with special emphasis on those which you consider of greatest importance to an individual in selling his way through life successfully?
I will not only describe the traits of an attractive personality, but before I have finished, I will also give you a simple formula with which all but one of these traits may be developed and maintained. The mere naming of these personality traits will be of little value to anyone unless he appropriates and uses them. We will begin the outline of the factors with a description of the most important of these, which is positive mental attitude. One may get a fair idea of the important part mental attitude plays in the affairs of an individual's life by considering the fact that it influences the tone of voice, the expression of the face, the posture of the body, and modifies every word that is spoken, as well as determining the nature of every emotion one feels. It does more than these. It modifies every thought one releases, thereby extending its influence to all within its range through the principle of telepathy. For the sake of contrast, let us list some of the disagreeable things that a bad mental attitude causes. It dampens a man's enthusiasm, curtails his initiative, overthrows his self-control, subdues his imagination, undermines his desire to be cooperative, makes him sullen and intolerant, and as if these were not enough damage to ensure a man's failure, it puts on the finishing touch by throwing his reasoning power out of gear. These are but a few of the ways in which a negative mental attitude may damage the individual himself, quite apart from the damage he does to others through his negative influences.
How does a negative mental attitude affect a salesman, starting out in the morning, Mr. Carnegie?
He would be better off far and away if he remained at home. He not only will not make the sales he would make if his mental attitude were pleasant, but he will make enemies and lose customers as well.
Would a negative mental attitude affect a professional man, such as, for instance, a lawyer or a doctor, Mr. Carnegie?
The lawyer who goes into court with a bad mental attitude will find the court and the jury opposing him, although he may have a perfectly just case. And the doctor who comes into the presence of his patients with a negative mental attitude will do them more harm than good, although he may be skilled in the knowledge of his profession. A man may have all the culture modern civilization can provide, and he may have a string of degrees after his name a yard long, and he may be the most skilled man in his field, but he will be a failure, as surely as 2 and 2 make 4, if he carries a bad mental attitude around with him. The one thing people simply will not tolerate is a negative mental attitude.
Mr. Carnegie, you have given us some examples of the results of a negative mental attitude. Now will you name an outstanding example of a man with a positive mental attitude, and how it affected his life?
Take Charlie Schwab, for example, whom I have paid as high as $1 million in extra bonus in a single year. Analyze his personality in minute detail, and you will come close to discovering why many of my associates have accumulated fortunes of their own. Charlie came to me as an ordinary laborer. He had but little schooling and very few special talents for anything. But he had one important asset that gives you the clue to his success. He had a perfect mental attitude toward himself and all others with whom he came into contact. Where and how did he come by that attitude? Well, he probably was born with a favorable background for the cultivation of such an attitude, but he acquired the habit of expressing it because he was associated with a group of men who made it a part of their daily duty to develop and maintain a positive mental attitude. Before we pass on to the next factor of attractive personality, Let me say that this subject of mental attitude will show up for consideration in connection with every one of the other qualities of personality we are to analyze. It is definitely related to all of them, a fact that is very significant.
Mr. Carnegie, since I am to present the philosophy of achievement to many realistic thinkers, I am keenly interested in the why and how of every principle you mention. Will you, therefore, give me an idea of how one may go about the development of such an attitude?
The simplest way to answer your question is to say that a positive mental attitude can be developed by understanding and applying all of the factors of attractive personality. You will see, therefore, when I finish my analysis of these qualities of personality, that I will have given the complete answer to your question.
Very well, Mr. Carnegie. I shall listen carefully to what you say so as to gather clues which may be helpful in the development of these desirable traits. What is the second factor of personality, sir?
Flexibility. By this term, I have reference to the ability to adapt oneself to quickly changing circumstances and emergencies without losing one's sense of balance. A man with a flexible disposition must be something like a chameleon, the little member of the reptile family that quickly changes its color to harmonize with its environment. Without this ability, an attractive personality is hardly possible, as the ever-changing conditions of life and of human relationships require individual adaptability. Some men are uncharitable enough to blame their misfortunes on others, but the truth is that every man is where he is and what he is because of his own mental attitude as it is expressed through his personality.
Why, Mr. Carnegie, that is a tremendous statement. It rules out almost completely the elements of luck and pull, which most people bemoan the lack of when evaluating their status in life.
Yes, indeed. When you present the philosophy of achievement, get the idea over in terms that will cause people to take honest inventory of themselves, so they may find and correct their faults of personality. I have often thought that it would be a blessing of the first magnitude if all public schools made the study of attractive personality a must requirement of their curricula. Young people should be taught very early in life that no amount of schooling will ensure their success unless they learn to negotiate with others pleasantly. And observe how definitely the quality of flexibility is related to one's mental attitude.
And that, Mr. Carnegie, brings us down to number three of the important factors of a pleasing personality, which is
sincerity of purpose. This is one trait of character for which there has never been found a satisfactory substitute. I say it is a trait of character because it is something that reaches deeper into a human being than any mere quality of personality. Sincerity of purpose, or the lack of it, writes itself so indelibly into the words and deeds of men that even the novice at character analysis can recognize its presence or its absence. The insincere person announces his weakness in every word he speaks, in the expression of his face, in the tread of his conversation, in his choice of intimate associates, in the sort of service he renders in connection with his occupation, and in other ways that are less noticeable, and this despite the fact that he may be a skilled actor with great ability to camouflage his real nature. The proverbial type of yes-man is an object of derision the world over, mainly because everyone recognizes his insincerity. I shall never forget the first definite opposition I experienced from Charlie Schwab. He had been with me only a short time when I called him in and gave him a definite order to make certain changes in his work which I believed should be made. He listened until I finished. Then he looked me squarely in the eyes with a broad, good-natured smile on his face and said, "All right, Chief, you are the boss, but I'm going to tell you that your request is going to cost you money because you haven't investigated this matter as closely as I have." There was something about the manner in which he spoke which left me no room to construe his remarks as insubordination, but I held up the order and investigated, only to find that he was right and I was wrong. From that day on, I began to watch Charlie very closely, only to discover in him qualities of both personality and character which made him of priceless value to me. You may say, therefore, that Charlie got his real start with me by his sincerity of purpose, for that is no exaggeration of the facts. Verily, it pays to include sincerity of purpose as one of the factors of personality.
With that sound truth still ringing in our ears, the ring of sincerity, if you please, Mr. Carnegie, we pass on to the fourth factor comprising a pleasing personality. Will you name it, sir?
It is promptness of decision. Observe men wherever you will, and you will notice that those who dilly-dally around, trying to make up their minds, are neither popular nor successful. This is a fast-moving world in which we live, and those who do not move quickly cannot keep up with the parade. Successful men reach decisions definitely and quickly, and they become annoyed and inconvenienced by others who do not act promptly. I call your attention to the fact that promptness of decision is a habit, and therefore it is definitely related to and a part of one's mental attitude. Try as you may, but you cannot separate any of these traits of attractive personality from their relationship to mental attitude. I call your attention also to the close relationship between promptness of decision and definiteness of purpose. Thus, you will observe that these traits of personality have a very direct connection with the entire 17 principles of the philosophy of achievement. We live in a country where individual achievement is possible on a grand scale because of the abundance of opportunity on every hand, but opportunity waits for no man. The man with the vision to recognize opportunity and the promptness of decision to embrace it will get ahead, but no others will. This is the way of the world. It always makes a place for the man who knows exactly what he wants and is determined to get it.
Mr. Carnegie, someone has said that courtesy is the cheapest yet the most profitable thing in the world. Where do you place this trait of personality, sir?
Courtesy is the very next factor to be discussed. It is an essential part of an attractive personality. As to its cheapness, I will go a step further and say it is absolutely free. All that costs is the time required to express it in one's daily contact with others. Perhaps its very cheapness accounts for its scarcity, as it is a quality of personality so rare that when one comes upon it, one is quick to take note of the person expressing it.
Well, Mr. Carnegie, just what is your definition of courtesy?
My idea of courtesy is this. It is the habit of respecting other people's feelings under all circumstances, the habit of going out of one's way to help any less fortunate person whenever and wherever possible, and last, but by no means least, the habit of controlling selfishness in all its forms. Again, take notice of the definite relationship between courtesy and one's mental attitude. Courtesy is a medium with which one may project his influence to sources of opportunity he could not reach without it.
And after courtesy, Mr. Carnegie, what comes next on the list of the essential elements of a pleasing personality?
Next, I shall mention a pair of twin brothers. The first one is tone of voice. The spoken word is, by great odds, the medium through which one expresses his personality most often. Therefore, the tone of one's voice should be so thoroughly under control that it can be colored and modified so as to make it carry a meaning quite in addition to the mere words expressed. For it does carry a separate meaning, whether one is conscious of this fact or not. The idea, therefore, is to so cultivate the voice that it can be used to convey the particular meaning desired. The man who has developed a 100% attractive personality knows how to convey, through the tone of his voice, every emotion he feels. He can express anger, fear, curiosity, contempt, doubt, affection, courage, sincerity, derision, anxiety, and a wide range of other feelings. Moreover, he makes it a habit to control his voice every time he speaks, for it is only through habit that one reaches perfection in the dramatization of speech. The price of perfection here, as is true in so many other things, is eternal practice. Every person who develops an attractive personality must study his own voice and place it under control, so he can make it convey any feeling he desires. If no teacher of voice is at hand, one can become his own teacher by practicing before a mirror until he gains perfection.
Did you say, Mr. Carnegie, that tone of voice was only one of a pair of twin brothers? What is the nature of the other brother, sir?
Oh, the other brother is the habit of smiling. Now, don't make the mistake of feeling that the simple habit of smiling is not an important part of one's personality. And don't forget that it is a habit that is directly associated with mental attitude. If you aren't sure about this, just try smiling when you are angry. I suggest that one should stand before a mirror when practicing voice control, because there are certain expressions of speech which cannot be dramatized properly unless they are accompanied by a smile.
Is it possible, Mr. Carnegie, that these twin brothers have some other close relatives? What is the next trait of a desirable personality, sir?
It is expression of the face. You may have heard it said that character analysts can tell, by a glance at the expression on one's face, much about the nature of one's character. Well, it is true, but character analysts are not alone in this ability to judge people by their facial expression. We all do it constantly, whether we do so consciously or not. You can tell a great deal of what is going on in one's mind by the expression on his face. Master salesman can tell, by careful observation of a prospective buyer's facial expression, much about what his real thoughts are. If they cannot do this, they are not master salesmen. Moreover, the clever salesman learned to judge what is going on in the other fellow's mind by the tone of his voice. Thus the smile, the tone of voice, the expression of the face, constitute an open window through which all who will may see and feel what takes place in the minds of people. This naturally suggests to the smart person the use of caution in connection with this open window. The smart person will know when to keep the window closed. He will also know when to open it.
Mr. Carnegie, I haven't been keeping too accurate account of the different traits of an attractive personality which you have mentioned, because of my intense interest in your remarks. Which trait is next, sir?
We are up to number 9, which is tactfulness. There is always a right time and a wrong time for everything. Tactfulness consists of the habit of doing and saying the right thing at the right time, and I'm going to enumerate for you a list of the more common ways in which people show their lack of tactfulness. I suggest that this list may be of immeasurable benefit as a checkup on one's personality. Here is the list. 1. Carelessness in the tone of the voice, often speaking in gruff, antagonistic tones that offend. 2. Speaking out of turn, when silence would be more appropriate. 3. Interrupting others who are speaking. 4. Overworking the personal pronoun. 5. Asking impertinent questions, generally to impress others with the questioner's own importance. 6. Injecting intimately personal subjects into the conversation, where such action is embarrassing to others. 7. Going where one has not been invited. 8. Boastfulness. 9. Flaunting the rules of society in matters of personal adornment. 10. Making personal calls at inconvenient hours. 11. Holding people on the telephone with needless conversation. 12. Writing letters to people whom one has no reasonable excuse for addressing. 13. Volunteering opinions when not requested, especially on subjects with which they are not familiar. 14. Openly questioning the soundness of the opinions of others. 15. Declining requests from others in an arrogant manner. 16. Speaking disparagingly of people in front of their friends. 17. Rebuking people who disagree with one on any subject. 18. Speaking of people's physical afflictions in their presence. 19. Correcting subordinates and associates in the presence of others. 20. Complaining when requests for favors are refused. 21, presuming upon friendship and asking favors. 22, using profane or offensive language. 23, expressing dislikes too freely. 24, speaking of ills and misfortunes. 25, criticizing our form of government or some other person's religion. 26, overfamiliarity on all occasions with people.
The person who checks his personality against that list and finds himself not to be a violator in any of those ways is indeed fortunate, and he is a rare individual. I can see that tactfulness is another trait of personality which is related to mental attitude. Now, Mr. Carnegie, what is coming up as number 10?
10th place goes to tolerance. Let us define tolerance simply as open-mindedness. The tolerant person is one who holds his mind open for new facts and new knowledge and new viewpoints on all subjects. I hazard the guess that this definition classifies most of us as being intolerant. Observe, too, before we get too far into the analysis of this subject, how closely related are tolerance and tactfulness, and also how definitely both are related to mental attitude. Try as you may, there is no escape from consideration of the subject of mental attitude. It crops up everywhere, in every human relationship. Before leaving this subject, I wish to enumerate a few of the specific handicaps which men set up for themselves through their intolerance. 1. It makes enemies of those who would like to be friends. 2. It stops the growth of the mind by limiting the search for knowledge. 3. It discourages imagination. 4. It prohibits self-discipline. 5. It prevents accuracy in thinking and reasoning. Added to all these, it also damages the character through unseen and unknown ways that limit one's use of the spiritual forces which are available to open minds.
Mr. Carnegie, you surely gave intolerance the stinging indictment it deserves. This rounds out the first 10 essential elements of a desirable personality. I suppose we might call them the Big 10 of a positive personality. And now for the next round, Mr. Carnegie. What is number 11?
The 11th trait of attractive personality is frankness of manner and speech. Everyone mistrusts the man who resorts to subterfuge instead of dealing frankly with his daily associates. I have known men who were so slippery that you could not pin them down to a direct, clear-cut statement on any subjects, and I have never yet seen a man of this type who could be depended upon. This sort of man doesn't come right out and lie, but he does what amounts to exactly the same thing by deliberately withholding important facts from those who have a right to know the facts. This habit is a form of dishonesty which, if indulged in very long, will undermine the soundest character. Men of sound character always have the courage to speak and deal directly with people, and they follow this habit, even though it may at times be to their personal disadvantage. Men who resort to subterfuge to deceive others seldom have very much confidence in themselves.
I'm sure, Mr. Carnegie, that everyone prefers dealing with a man who is frank and honest. In the long run, people who think they are deceiving others are only deceiving themselves. But, Mr. Carnegie, what is number 12 in this series of desirable personality traits?
Number 12 is a keen sense of humor. A well-developed sense of humor aids a man in becoming flexible and adjustable to the varying circumstances of life. It also enables him to relax and become human instead of remaining cool and distant. Moreover, a keen sense of humor keeps a man from taking himself and life too seriously, a tendency toward which altogether too many people are inclined. I always feel sorry for the man who cannot or will not relax and laugh when it is proper for him to do so, for laughter is the finest of mental tonics. I am not so sure but what it is also a good physical tonic. A keen sense of humor, no matter how it is indulged, provides relaxation. The people of America spend millions of dollars annually for the circus and the stage and screenplays to provide such an escape. A sense of humor even serves to give one a better physical appearance, too, as it helps to keep the lines of the face softened. It also leads to the habit of smiling, which is one of the important traits of attractive personality. And there is a definite relationship between a sense of humor and a mental attitude. A keen sense of humor encourages a positive mental attitude.
Mr. Carnegie, you make it very clear that an attractive personality is an asset of the greatest worth to anyone. The factors you are presenting will make it possible for people to take inventory of their personality assets, as well as any possible liabilities. Your suggestions and instructions will enable them to strengthen any weak spots and thus increase their ability to negotiate with life on more favorable terms. What is the next trait necessary to the development of an attractive personality?
Now we come to the most profound and far-reaching of all the elements comprising an attractive personality: faith in infinite intelligence. Faith is woven into every principle of the philosophy of achievement, since the intangible power of faith is the essence of every great achievement, no matter what may be its nature or purpose. My analysis of this subject, therefore, is a responsibility I dare not neglect. To do so would be something like trying to teach astronomy without reference to the stars. Understand, however, that any reference I make to the subject of faith has nothing whatsoever to do with the supernatural, nor has it any theological connotations. I shall speak of the power of faith only as it is an inescapable necessity to the man who wishes to make the fullest use of his mind for the attainment of material ends. No philosophy dealing with the subject of personal achievement would be complete without a definite and direct recognition of the power of faith. The reason for this is that the state of mind known as faith provides the greatest outlet for the expression of initiative, imagination, enthusiasm, self-reliance, and definiteness of purpose. Without it, no one could rise above mediocrity. To neglect the subject of faith would therefore be something like providing a man with an intricate piece of machinery without giving him any power with which to operate it.
Are you saying, Mr. Carnegie, that a man's brain is actually a piece of very fine machinery, intricately and accurately constructed to perform a definite function in the business of living?
That I am. And the power that operates this machine is a form of energy which comes from the outside, and faith is the master gate through which an individual may give his brain full and free access to the great universal power which operates it. The hand that opens the gate and permits the free entry of the power that operates the brain is desire or motive. No one has ever yet discovered any other method of opening the gate. There are various degrees to which it can be opened, all depending upon motive and desire. Only those desires which take on the proportion of an obsession, burning desires, serve to open wide the valve. A burning desire, in the sense that I am using this term, is one that is accompanied by a deep emotional feeling. Mere head desires, growing out of pure reason, do not open the gate to the brain as widely as heart desires that are mixed with emotion. I wish to make this point very clear, and to emphasize it in every way possible, for it is the very warp and woof of the subject of faith.
Mr. Carnegie, can you give us a few illustrations of the practical benefits to be derived by those who learn to use the power of faith?
I would start out by saying that the state of mind known as faith automatically wipes out intolerance by freeing the mind of the man-made limitations. After all, what is intolerance but a partially closed mind? Just as darkness is dispelled by the simple process of turning on the light, so is intolerance eliminated by opening the mind for the influx of the power that gives the brain the vision to encompass all of life's realities instead of only a few of them. Next, I'd say that opening the mind, through faith, provides one with a greater perspective of the world about him and the people that live in it. This same receptiveness paves the way for a better understanding in all human relationships. Therefore, it serves to support all the traits of attractive personality. The third benefit to those who use the power of faith is that an open mind allows the influx of power that removes all the imaginary obstacles in the way of individual achievement and aids in surmounting the real obstacle. As one man so aptly stated this truth, where faith is the guide, the individual cannot lose his way.
Mr. Carnegie, will you name in order the facts you consider to be most significant in connection with this subject of faith?
One fact of deep significance is that the power available through faith is inexhaustible, and there are no penalties of any nature whatsoever for the free use of this power. This fact connotes the intention of the Creator for full and complete use of this universal power by all who desire to use it, and for every purpose essential for man's welfare. It is also significant that the method of contacting and using this power is simple and within the reach of every person. It consists of voluntary appropriation of the power through the medium of desire or motive. Still another profound fact is that the power of thought is the only thing over which any human being has complete control, and the individual's prerogative in this respect has been cleverly protected by a system which makes it impossible for one individual to know what use another makes of the power of thought.
It would appear, then, Mr. Carnegie, that the only real privacy a man has is that which he enjoys within himself and his own thoughts, in the chambers of his own mind. This in itself is a profound and awe-inspiring truth.
Aye, and the man who fails to grasp the significance of the facts we have mentioned can never have an attractive personality in the fullest meaning of that term. The man who does understand and apply them thereby removes all limitations from his own mind. The promise of reward is worthy of all the effort one may put into understanding.
Now, Mr. Carnegie, what is the next trait of attractive personality?
It's a keen sense of justice. It seems trite to remind people that an individual cannot hope to become popular and attractive unless he deals justly with others. But man's well-known deficiency in this respect makes it necessary to discuss this subject.
Perhaps, Mr. Carnegie, it would be well for you to define what you mean by justice.
Justice, as I use the term here, has reference to intentional honesty. Many people are honest for the sake of expediency, but their brand of honesty is so flexible that they can stretch it to fit any circumstance where their immediate interests can be best extended. It is not that brand of honesty we are analyzing. We are talking about deliberate honesty that is so rigidly adhered to that the individual is motivated by it under circumstances that may not be to his immediate benefit, the same as to those that promise the greatest possible reward.
Mr. Carnegie, would you care to name some of the more obvious practical benefits of a keen sense of justice?
It embellishes the basis of confidence, without which no one can have an attractive personality. It builds a fundamentally sincere and sound character, which, of itself, is one of the greatest of all attracting forces. It not only attracts people, but it offers opportunities for personal gain in one's occupation. It gives one a feeling of self-reliance and self-respect. It places one in a better and more understanding relationship with one's own conscience. It attracts friends and discourages enemies. It clears the way for that state of mind known as faith. It protects one from the destructiveness of controversies with other people. It helps one to move with more initiative in connection with one's major purpose in life. It never damages one, nor does it subject one to any form of embarrassment. A keen sense of justice not only aids in the development of attractive personality, but it is an asset of priceless value in almost every human relationship. It discourages avarice, greed, and selfishness, and gives an individual a much better understanding of his rights, privileges, and responsibilities. A keen sense of justice has a very definite and very great contributory influence in the development of the other traits of attractive personality.
Mr. Carnegie, That brings us down to number 15 of the traits of a pleasing personality, which is
appropriateness of words. Among cultured people, there is perhaps no greater source of annoyance than the careless use of words. Colloquialisms and slang may be passable at times, but the less these are used, the better. The English language is replete with a stock of words possessing every possible shade of meaning. Hence, there can be no valid excuse for the common habit of using words which offend. And, of course, the use of profane words at any time is inexcusable.
Mr. Carnegie, could you suggest a method whereby a person may assure himself of an adequate and appropriate vocabulary?
A man of my acquaintance whose accomplishment in the use of words is the most outstanding of any person I have ever known devotes 30 minutes daily to reading the dictionary. Yes, literally, reading it. He has an astonishingly large vocabulary, and I have never heard him use an inappropriate word in my life. Moreover, his choice of words shows that he uses only those which convey the precise meaning intended.
Now that you mention it, Mr. Carnegie, it is true that the words a man uses are the gauge by which he is first judged by others, and they therefore assume tremendous importance as a factor of personality.
The words are the media through which a man most often expresses his thoughts. So the nature of the words he uses give an accurate clue to the type of mind he possesses. This fact leads me to the conclusion that two things should be on the must list of daily habits of every person who has an attractive personality: care in the choice of words, and care in the tone of voice in which words are expressed.
As a result of your analysis, Mr. Carnegie, the thought has just struck me. What a wonderful thing a word is! I wish you would continue developing the importance of words for a moment.
The ability to express thoughts through the use of words is one of the definite distinctions which separate man from all other living things. Words are the Creator's ingenious means by which man has been given an unlimited outlet for the expression of his thoughts. Words are God's special gift to man. With this gift, the combined knowledge and experience of mankind may become the common property of the humblest individual. If we had no words with which to convey thoughts, the use of the mastermind principle would be exceedingly limited, and every man would be practically compelled to go through life without benefiting by the knowledge gained by men before him.
Now, Mr. Carnegie, what is the 16th trait of an attractive personality?
I have termed it emotional control. It has been said by men who have studied the subject that man's emotions control his conduct. The claim seems reasonable. Most of us are directed not so much by our reason as by our emotions. We do things, or we refrain from doing them, because of the way we feel. Emotion, therefore, may be defined with one word: feeling. This is a mighty important word, since it defines the motivating force which controls most of our actions throughout life. We certainly owe it to ourselves to learn as much as possible about the force which lifts us to great achievements or hurls us downward to defeat. That is precisely what the power of emotion does. In view of this significant fact, we should get control over this power, not only to add to the attractiveness of our personality, but to ensure us against a life of failure and misery.
What do you suggest as the first step toward gaining such control over our emotions, Mr. Carnegie?
The first step is to identify the emotions so we will recognize them. And to aid us in this task, a noted psychologist has prepared a list of the most common emotions expressed in our daily lives. There are 7 positive emotions and 7 negative emotions. I shall give you the negative emotions first. The 7 negative emotions are 1. Fear. There are 7 different forms of fear, which we shall discuss later. 2. Jealousy. 3. Hatred and envy. 4. Revenge and malice. 5. Greed. 6. Superstition and distrust. 7. Anger. Now for the 7 positive emotions, which are 1, love, 2, sex, 3, hope, 4, faith, 5, desire, 6, optimism, 7, loyalty. In these 14 emotions, one may find the letters of the alphabet of a language that spells either success or failure. These 14 words literally represent the keyboard of the musical instrument of life, on which an individual plays the chords of harmony that lead to happiness in its fullest meaning, or the discords of unhappiness that lead to misery and obscurity. Each of the 14 emotions is related to mental attitude. This is why I have stressed the importance of mental attitude. These 14 emotions represent nothing except mental attitude. They are nothing but feelings or states of mind. More important still, they are subject to organization, guidance, and complete control by any normal person. Here is the keyboard of life on which an individual may compose the tune that his soul will sing all through life.
In what way has the Creator given man control over this grand score for the symphony of life, Mr. Carnegie?
By giving man control over his powers of thought. The only thing the individual has to do is to take charge of his own mind and exercise this control. That is something he cannot neglect or avoid without condemning his entire life to the stray winds of chance. Remember, before we leave this subject, that the point at which an individual begins to take control of his own mind, and this includes emotions, of course, is when he adopts a definite major purpose. Definiteness of purpose is the starting point of all achievement. You see, therefore, how definitely success and failure are related to the 14 emotions. One half of the 14 are harbingers of failure. The other half are success builders.
I dare say, Mr. Carnegie, that anyone who secures a copy of this list of the 14 emotions and who carefully examines himself in connection with each of them on the basis of a definite schedule will make tremendous strides towards gaining control of his emotions.
That is correct. A person should construct a check chart and make a habit of rating himself on each one of the emotions daily. The experiment will surprise anyone who attempts it. It may also lead to changes in one's personality, which will agreeably surprise all of his associates. This is a positive approach to self-mastery, the end which must be sought and attained by all who wish to be sure of making life pay.
Mr. Carnegie, you have covered the first 16 of the traits of an attractive personality. What is coming up now, sir?
Let us call it alertness of interest in persons, places, and things. Without the ability to fix one's interest at will on any subject or person and hold it there for whatever time the occasion requires, no person will have an attractive personality. You can pay another person no greater compliment, generally speaking, than that of concentrating your attention upon him when he desires your attention. It has been said that it is a greater accomplishment to be able to listen well than it is to be able to talk well. This is one way in which a person may please others and at the same time acquire usable knowledge. The habit of looking in some other direction, of fidgeting with some pocket gadget when others are talking, is among the worst forms of effrontery. The habit of interrupting when others are speaking is an unpardonable insult. Strong language, perhaps, but accurately descriptive of an important fact.
Are you implying, Mr. Carnegie, that lack of observation is what is going on around one, and failure to notice details is an all-too-common weakness?
Precisely that. It is a common weakness that costs people a tremendous price. If one will make a careful study of oneself when conversing with others, he may discover that he can add substantially to his own personality by taking a keener interest in the other fellow's personality. I have often suggested to some of the young men who worked with us that if they would become as alertly interested in the associates with whom they work and in their jobs as they do when talking to their sweethearts, The results would show a healthy change in their pay envelopes. Alertness of interest in other people not only serves to please them, but it also provides one with an excellent opportunity to know people by observing their mannerisms. One may learn valuable lessons by observing the faults as well as the virtues of other people, as this habit causes one to take more accurate inventory of himself, to make sure he does not display the same faults.
It would seem to me, Mr. Carnegie, that the memory would be associated with this matter of alertness of interest and observation. Am I correct in this assumption, sir?
Everyone knows that a good memory is an asset of great value. But not everyone seems to know that one of the greatest functions of a good memory is that of taking accurate inventory of and remembering the characteristics of individual personalities. Such retentiveness always requires keen observation and intensity of interest in ordinary conversation with people. Few circumstances annoy a person more than to be introduced to someone a second time without that person showing any sign of recognition. Such situations occur every day. It is no compliment to a man, and especially if he be a man of considerable reputation in his field, to be made to feel that he is so unimpressive and unimportant that someone to whom he has been introduced a second time does not remember him. Conversely stated, nothing pleases a man more than to have people show that they remember him, and favorably. One of New York's largest hotels employs a desk man who has a system by which he remembers practically every person who registers at that hotel a second time, and he never misses if the person is fairly well known to the public. He calls people by their names and lets them know that he recognizes them. The manager of that hotel told me that this man is one of the greatest assets of the hotel. And what is still more interesting, he receives almost 3 times as much salary as the job he holds usually pays. It is part of a man's duty, to himself at least, to see everyone he knows and to recognize his acquaintances in some manner every time he comes within speaking distance of them. Lack of alertness of interest in other people is usually a sign of egotism. One who falls in love with himself will find few rivals.
Everyone readily agrees that an attractive personality is greatly to be desired and sought after. The elements comprising a pleasing personality, which you have presented thus far, will make a wonderful list by which people may compare their own personalities, counting up their assets and their liabilities, if any. You have previously covered the first 17 desirable personality traits. What have you in store for me today?
The 18th trait of an attractive personality is effective speech. The person who cannot stand on his feet and speak with force and conviction on any subject within the range of his knowledge is under a great handicap as far as the attraction of people is concerned. The same applies to the man who cannot express himself forcefully in ordinary conversation and in small group gatherings, such as business conferences. There is a general acceptance of the belief that the ability to dramatize words and express them forcefully at all times, under all conditions, is among the greatest of human achievement. In fact, some people place this power at the head of the list of all personal achievements. Times without number, as we can see by examining the history of mankind, the entire trend of civilization has been influenced by men who could dramatize an idea with the spoken word. We have only to look around us to find men who have risen to great heights of personal achievement because of their ability to sell themselves to other people through dramatized speech. Let it be remembered that in my use of the term speech, I have reference to man's spoken words as a means of influencing others, whether he is speaking to one person or to many.
It might be helpful, Mr. Carnegie, if you were to mention some of the steps one must take to prepare to give an effective speech.
By far the most important factor of effective speech is a thorough knowledge of the subject on which one speaks. No amount of dramatic technique will ever take the place of the self-assurance a speaker feels when he knows his subject. Someone whose hobby was terseness of speech once said that a whole course on public speaking could be taught in one sentence. Know what you wish to say, and say it with all the feeling you can command, and then sit down. The last two words are important. The time to stop speaking is the exact moment at which you have conveyed the thought you wish to get over, and not 1 second beyond that time. Long-winded speakers generally are boresome, but the short speech will be no less so if it does not say something that people wish to hear and say it effectively.
Several times, Mr. Carnegie, you have used the word dramatize in connection with effective speech. Just how is the ability to dramatize acquired?
The ability to dramatize speech comes through habit. Therefore, one should begin this habit by speaking forcefully in ordinary conversation. There is the place where great speakers learn the art of effective speech. They practice on every person with whom they converse. They never utter a word without placing back of it the necessary feeling.